Hi, everybody. Welcome to this week's Blind Like Me. I, of course, am Phil Farr. That's not going to change, is it? I suppose not. It is raining in Texas on Monday morning, the 20th of the month of March. Our guest from up around the Boston area is Bob Gilday. Did I say it right? Gilday.
You did.
I did. You're very critical of the... You like your name pronounced a certain way, don't you?
Yep.
Is that Irish? Is it?
Yes.
It is Gilday.
Yep.
And Gilday makes it sound kind of like a guy from Texas or something, right? Mr. Gilday. That's the way a hillbilly would pronounce it. Of course, we have a lot of good hillbillies on our list. You had told me yesterday your age. You're not bothered by that. How old are you?
In 7 weeks, I'll be 82.
82. So you don't even buy green bananas anymore, right? That's the old
answer. I like that.
Well, you can have it. I'll give it to you. You can
Thank
use
you.
It. You
I'll
can,
use it.
You can take that and use it. So you are. What is your level of vision, sir?
Very little. It's a tiny bit better than light perception, but it's not quite object vision.
But a little better than light. In other words, you won't run into a wall, but that's about all the good it does you, right?
I do run into walls.
Do you? We all do. Yeah, but you can't, by any stretch of the imagination, see the computer screen.
That's true.
So, for all practical purposes, you're totally blind. You might
as far as that's concerned, yes.
Might as well say that. Now, how long have you been that way? Were you born totally blind? Or?
No. When I was 14, before I went into high school, I had a problem with my eyes. And every 6 months or thereabouts, I'd have 3 to 5 days of pain in one eye or the other or both. And then the sight would go away, way down to just light perception.
Yeah.
And then it would take 2 months for it to come back up, but never quite got back to where it was. And this happened repeatedly to the point where in June of 1944.
All right.
I was declared legally blind by the Mass Commission for the Blind here.
And so,
then the Division of the Blind, I think.
So you would have these pains, then your vision would go away and then gradually come back, or one day
yep.
you'd wake up and...
It would be off for about a month, and then the next month it would start to come back.
Well, I've heard of all kinds of conditions, but that's a new one. That's has anyone ever determined the cause of that?
They translated it into Latin and charged my father a lot of money. It was called retrobulbar neuritis.
Retrobulbar neuritis.
Neuritis.
Neuritis, which means, do we know what that means?
It means behind the eyeball... There was the eye nerve that had neuritis.
All right. And we all know what neuritis is.
Yep.
So they declared you legally blind at age 14. Up until then, had they...
No.
No?
No.
No?
Legally blind when I was about 19 or 20.
Okay.
The thing started it when I was 14.
How did they attempt in your early years to educate you? Did they send you to regular school, or what? How'd that work?
When I had only one eye bad, I was able to attend school. When I had two eyes bad, I stayed home, and a teacher came, home teacher, mm-hmm. and gave me instruction.
Now, this was in the same part of the country you're in now. Was this in Massachusetts, in Boston?
Yes.
Around that area?
Yes.
And so you were in a big city. Had you been in the country, there wouldn't have been any teacher, would there, if you...
I don't know. Never tried it.
Probably not. Probably if you lived out in a rural area, there wouldn't have been anybody. So the teacher came and instructed you. Did she attempt to teach you Braille?
No. That was never considered.
Never considered for Braille teaching.
Right. See, I was not legally blind at this time.
That's true.
My sight would come back and it would be pretty good.
And when it came back, you'd be off to public school again or what?
Yep, yep.
Man, what a childhood. What a thing.
2 months of out of school. I remember one 2 month period out of school in my senior year in high school. I had a little thing going with the physics professor. I was a little bit forward and aggressive, and I'd catch him up on his grammatical mistakes or whatever, and he'd try to embarrass the hell out of me.
Yeah?
And so we had a little contest going. And so that marking period, 2 month marking period, I didn't sit in the physics class one day.
Uh-huh.
I came in to visit the class on a Friday at the end of the 2 months, and they were taking the test. I had studied with that home teacher. So I said, I'd like to take the test. He says, okay, wait in the hall. I'll bring you in later. So he brought me in later, and I said, if you read the question to me, I have enough sight now so I can write the answer, but I need to have you read the question. So we did that.
Mm-hmm.
A week and a half later, he's handing out the blue books. And a couple of kids with 40s and 50% marks, and some at 60. Well, a lot of them at 70, three or so in the 80s. And by the time there's only one or two things left on the table, I said, oh, heck, he didn't even bother to mark mine.
Yeah.
And then he says, oh, there's one left here. Oh, this must be yours, Mr. Gilday. I got a 91, the best mark in the class.
So you could see enough to write the answers, but you couldn't read the questions.
Correct.
And you made the highest mark in the class, and you had not been in the class, but you had studied the literature.
That's correct.
So an early interest in physics.
Yeah.
What do you attribute that to? Any certain thing in your life?
I've always been kind of interested in things, mechanical things, electric things, electronic.
Mm-hmm.
I built my own crystal radio when I was 10 or 11. And I used to build balsa wood and paper airplanes.
Uh-huh. Now, you were born in 23, is the way 24, the way I figured. So when you were 10 years old, there weren't many radio stations on 1934, were there? There was those big, powerful stations, about all there was at night, that you could hear on that crystal radio.
There were quite a few in the Boston area.
Is that right?
Yeah, during the day. Oh, yeah.
I guess WBZ came on in the 20s, probably, didn't it?
Yep.
Probably back sometime in the 20s. So you built a crystal radio, and you were interested in mechanical things. Your parents were, you weren't in a rural setting. You were in the city. Is that right? Am I right?
My father was assistant director of music in the Boston Public Schools.
Oh.
And my mother was a home person.
Uh-huh.
I had three sisters, one older, two younger. And we moved from Newton Corner from the first 8 years of my life to be inside Boston limits,
mm-hmm.
to West Roxbury in 1932. And then in 43... we didn't need that anymore, and we moved to Milton, which is a suburb of Boston, just south of Boston.
But all this time, your father was, you say, head of the music department at the Boston Public Schools?
Assistant director, yes.
Assistant director. Did any of that music rub off on you? Did you pursue music of any kind?
Well, I used to sing in the choir. I did take piano lessons for a while. I did take trumpet, first bugle, then trumpet, then trombone.
Mm-hmm.
I played trombone in the Boston College marching band for the football games.
Okay. But that's as far as it went. You didn't want to pursue that as a career or anything, did you?
No.
You're lucky.
I did do quite a bit of singing.
You're a lucky man if you didn't do music. So you graduated high school, I guess, with good academic grades, with high marks. Is that right?
Sort of, yeah. I went to Boston College High School for 2 years. And then they did not teach science. So I went over to Boston English High School for the last 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And that way I got physics and chemistry. And that was called a technology course. And while I was in high school, I studied five foreign languages also.
Really?
Yeah.
You like that sort of thing?
I liked it a lot, but I never kept it up. I did take foreign language proficiency for my master's degree in applied math.
In college?
In graduate school.
Yeah, well,
in
let's
French.
Let's do some things before that. What did you think? Because this was like the early 40s, the war.
Yep.
The war had started in 42, and so you graduated probably in 42 or 43.
45.
45. All
from
right. So you were
college.
So you were 21. What did you think a blind person could do to make a living at that point in 1945? What were your thoughts?
There was a Father Tom Carroll that I knew, met in 1944. And he took me around with him, visiting different people and different blind folks. And one of the things that I noticed was that there are quite a few blind folks running stands.
Uh-huh.
They sold coffee and cigarettes and candy and stuff. I knew there were some musicians, but that's about it. I later on found out there was Cliff Witcher, Dr. Cliff Witcher, who was at MIT and had been at AFB.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know which went first, which was second, AFP.
But he was
MIT or MIT to AFP.
He was a blind person?
Yep.
And
a doctorate.
And he was a professor there or what?
Yep.
Well, so that must have given you hope.
Yep.
You know, that must have piqued your interest. So you decided, of course, to go to continue your education. 1945, graduated high school. What did you?
No, I graduated from high school in 42.
In 42, okay.
I got my bachelor's degree in 45.
All right, well, let's talk about college. Where did you go to get that bachelor's degree?
Boston College.
Boston College.
I took a B.S. in physics.
In physics? What did you think you could do with that degree in physics?
I took the physics course because you get more math in that course than you do in the AB physics class.
Okay, but you couldn't read Braille.
True.
So how did you get, did you have someone, how did you study?
I had people read to me. Some of them were paid, some of the volunteers.
And they read the lesson to you. How did you take the test? Orally?
Orally.
That's pretty progressive of Boston College, and they agreed to let you do that, of course.
Yep. I'll give you an idea of some of the contrasting things. I took a religion final. It was a 3-hour final for the rest of the class. And he said, give me 5 minutes, then come down to the front. So I did that. And he read the question, I answered it. He read the question, I answered it. It took 8 minutes from the time I left the back of the room to go up to him until I was back in the back of the room. And the other folks were taking 2-3 hours. Eight minutes for me.
So it took 8 minutes for you to answer all the questions.
Yep.
And the sighted students and were given 3 hours to do in which to do this test.
Yep. It's fun.
Good heavens. That seems completely out of... You knew all the answers, though, right?
That's right.
So he'd read the question, you'd hit him with the answer. Boom, 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 boom.
That's the way it went.
And so what did you do? Just sit there till the rest of them got through?
Or I was standing beside the desk where he was up on a platform with a desk up there. And so I just stood in front of him and... standing on the floor.
And this was in religious studies, did you say?
Religion, right.
Religion. Why did you take that? Was that just an elective, something you thought you'd enjoy? Or?
No, I was at the time I was a Catholic.
Uh-huh.
Brought up as Catholic. And if you're a Catholic, you have to take philosophy and religion.
Okay.
The philosophy test I had one time was a little different story.
Okay.
It was a quiz. 1 hour, 50-minute quiz. And he said, in one of the things, he said, what does St. Thomas say about an agent acting through means? I says, I don't know, but here's my answer, and I gave it to him.
Uh-huh.
2¾ hours later, we finished. This was a 50-minute test. 2¾ hours later... he said, okay, that's all. I found out later when I went to the book and had somebody read to me that part of St. Thomas's works,
mm-hmm.
that the answer I gave him was exactly the same as St. Thomas, so I must have read it and forgot that I had read it. But I remembered the concepts.
Now,
he was testing me to see how good I was. Was I just being a wise ass?
You're saying that it took you this long to give him that answer?
No. He questioned me on so many other things.
Okay.
That he wanted to test to see whether I was paying attention to his class.
Yeah.
Or was I reading other things in addition?
Mm-hmm.
So he really lambasted me with questions.
In physics, getting a physics degree, aren't there... drawings and things that you'd have to do? How did you handle those?
Well, in the laboratory, you usually have a lab partner. And my partner would do the reading and writing up the report. And I'd try and do as much of the actual physical work as possible.
Mm-hmm. And I know you had some idea or some thought. Of course, this is physics is what you were interested in. But what did you think a blind fella could do with a degree in physics in 1945?
I had no idea.
I love it. You had no idea. You had the degree, but you had no idea what to do with it.
Right. So from 1945 to 1950. In 45 to 46,
uh-huh.
I took a year's worth of all the courses for the Masters in Applied Math.
Okay.
And then for the next 4 years, I didn't get around to writing the thesis until the very end. So I got the degree in 1950.
You finally got the Master's degree in 1950.
Right.
And this was majoring in physics and minoring in what?
No, it was... in applied math.
Applied math. Well, thing that I don't much know what a blind person in 1950 even would do with a degree in applied math. I'll tell you what, Bob, for We're a little past time. Let's take just a short little break here and be back with Bob Gaudet in just a few minutes. Where you're listening to Blind Like Me, I'm Phil Parr. Hang on.
Thing I like the best about the Blind Handyman List, great place to exchange information and gather ideas on anything to do with being a handyman around the house.
I found out how to fix my garbage disposal on the Handyman List. And it works.
If you'd like to join the Blind Handyman List, send a blank email to blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. That's blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
The thing I like about the Blind Handyman List, I'm the moderator, and I can delete you if I want to. So don't get out of line. Stay on topic.
That's blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
A trip to Walmart.
I wonder where the pharmacy is. It's somewhere over here. Oh, God, I've got my cane caught in something.
Pardon me, sir. I don't know how to tell you this, but the end of your cane is stuck in my...
Why bother shopping the big discount stores when you can shop from the comfort of your own home at BlindMySmart.com?
Hi, this is Dale Campbell, president of Blind My Smart. If you can't find what you're looking for today, check back tomorrow. We're adding new products every day.
Blind My Smart, with thousands of products at a completely accessible website. Our address is blindmysmart.com. Again, that's www.blindmysmart.com. Blind Sites. Here's a website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Sites, here's Tim Cummings.
Are you a person that has either a dog or a cat or fish or whatever for pets, and you need to get pet supplies or pet food? Well, you should take a look at www.petdiscounters.com. It's a very accessible website. If you've got like a pet hermit crab, I don't know how many people have pet hermit crabs, but they have supplies for pet hermit crabs. If you've got a reptile like a snake or whatever, and you're looking for cages or supplies or whatever you want for your pet, you should check it out. I'd give it a screen reader friendliness rating of a 9. Again, that's www.petdiscounters.com. For Blind Sites, this is Tim Cummings saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sites.
In March of 1950, I had been, for now 4 years, doing nothing, hanging around the house and reading talking books and going crazy and sleeping 12 hours and sleeping 18 hours or 3 hours, or all crazy schedule.
Doing nothing?
Yeah, just reading books.
Reading books how?
Talking books.
Oh, reading talking books.
Yeah, the big 12-inch things.
They had big 12-inch records back then, and there was about 15 or 20 minutes on each side, and you'd have to flip the record over, and
yep.
A big book would be just a great big heavy cumbersome thing.
Right.
But the National Library Service was up and running then.
Yes, it started in 1935.
And they were sending you books all you
Not
wanted.
Not the National Library Service. The Library of Congress.
Yeah.
Division for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. NLS only came in a few years ago.
Is that right? Okay, but they were sending you books, all you wanted, books through the mail at that time. So you're just reading books and sleeping and doing nothing with your master's degree in applied math.
Right.
Oh,
in March of 50, I finally got a job at the Cambridge Industries for the Blind.
Oh,
I wanted to do something to give me regular hours and straighten me out. And so that's work I could do. You know, it's physical work. I could do that. So I worked there for, I guess it was 3 years.
Right.
And on March 2nd, 1953, I got a job at MIT as night supervisor of the math group working on the big computer called Whirlwind.
Well, now, before that, this Blind Industries place, what did they do? What sort of work did they do?
They made brooms.
They made brooms.
Yep.
So you learned how to make a broom.
I did, indeed.
Oh, boy, that's coming.
I not only learned how to make them, and the big ones, I trimmed them off, cut the ends off square, and then I'd tie them up in a bundle. Very involved work.
It was, but it was something to do.
Exactly.
It was something to do to keep you occupied and keep you from going crazy.
That's for sure.
Which is what you needed, because you were a young fellow there, 21, 25 years old, needed something to do. So you got this job at MIT as night
supervisor.
Of the math group.
Yep,
is that right?
The math group.
Uh-huh.
The math group had a bunch of people programming the computer to do mathematical kinds of research. Now, the kids that were running the computer were high school kids, graduates. I had 2 degrees that were applicable to this kind of work, a B.S. Physics and an M.S. Applied Math. So they were tickled to get me to be the supervisor. And now if I could handle the kids, I was in like Flynn.
Yeah.
So it worked out very well. I worked there 22 months. Then I got a job at transferred inside MIT to Lincoln Lab. And I was on the staff as a programmer. And I worked there for another 15 months. Then I got a job with the Radio Corporation of America Airborne Systems Lab. And I worked there for 10 and a half years. Then I went to the MITRE Corporation as a systems engineer for the next 20 years.
Well,
I retired completely in 1986.
Let's back up a little bit. What did you do for the Radio Corporation of America?
Most of the time I was supervising a computing group with desk calculators. And that grew into, we bought a electronic computer called a Burroughs E101. And it was a program, you programmed it with a plug board, a series of plug boards. And so some of the students, some of the colleagues I had were doing the programming and doing other programming for other computers outside of RCA, but for RCA's work in airborne stuff.
Now, plug boards, you mean a board that you would punch holes in the right configuration and put it in the slot, and the computer would see that? And
the holes were all there. You just had to put a little thing into it.
Uh-huh. So it's like a punch card. It's the same.
It was a completely punched card, and then you filled up one of those things by putting a little, like a stylus, into the hole to complete a circuit.
If you wanted to complete that circuit.
Yes, right.
So, but
and the selection of those holes on the left side were the commands, and on the right side were the addresses for the different registers.
But we're still just talking about either open or closed.
Yeah. Well, it was binary.
Yeah, binary. We're still talking, the same thing. And so this, what year was all this, this RCA stuff?
From 1956 to 1966.
So they realized that computers were going to be something then, or they were trying to get one to do some work for them, or what were they?
Oh, yes, definitely. One of the projects we were involved with is an airborne laboratory, an airborne computer, programming an airborne computer. We were using computers for digital solutions to a whole series of 100 or 200 equations that they would be putting onto the analog computers.
Okay. What do you mean by airborne? I don't. You've lost me there. You mean a Ford
in a fighter.
Oh, in an airplane.
Airplane fighter.
Okay.
You would need a computer to control, to be the fire control, to shoot missiles or to shoot machine guns or whatever.
Okay.
It was missiles that we were concerned with.
And this was obviously a military project of some sort.
Definitely.
That RCA, a civilian company, was helping our government with, I suppose.
Right. Contract with the Air Force.
Yeah. Okay, so RCA for 10 years, Radio Corporation of America was a big deal back then.
Yep.
It was one of the major companies that they owned NBC Television and radio, and you could go to a dealer and you could buy an RCA TV or an RCA radio record player. RCA made all sorts of things.
I have beside me here a brailled up, it's sold that way, RCA 6900 AM FM TV radio.
That has braille on the dials.
Yep.
Yeah, I had one at one time years ago.
A flat thing, yeah.
Yeah, a flat thing with knobs. The knobs are kind of down in a little hole. Yeah, I had one of those. It only gets the bottom 13 channels, though, doesn't it?
Right.
Bottom 12
yep.
channels. I had one of those. And another thing it didn't have that I didn't understand, it didn't have an earphone jack.
Yes, you're correct.
And my father was a ham operator. He put me an earphone jack on the thing. I just never could understand for blind people. It did not possess an earphone jack. I believe, did Radio Shack sell those, or who sold those? I can't remember.
Well, I worked for RCA, so I got it that way.
So you probably got a free one, didn't you? And you still have it.
I bought another one just recently.
I didn't know you could still buy them.
Well, it was a personal sale.
Oh, I was going to say, it'd be worth a lot of money on eBay. If you knew about eBay. All right, so RCA for 10 years, and then you went back to where?
Went to the MITRE Corporation for 20.
Now, what is the MITRE Corporation? What do they do?
That was a not-for-profit that helped the government, mostly the Air Force, Electronic Systems Division, that was stationed at Hanscom Field in Massachusetts, Lexington, Mass.
And
the MITRE Corporation was in Bedford, Mass., the next town over,
uh-huh.
3 miles away. When I first started with MITRE, I was on the base. The computer we were on was called the XD1.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the utility department.
Meaning maintenance? Meaning what? Meaning...
writing programs for use with the computer for utility purposes. One of them would be, and I worked on two or three different programs. One of them was an assembler where you converted English stuff into the machine language. Another was to write that stuff in a higher level language for checkout purposes. So the assembly level language was instruction by instruction. The higher level language was one statement would probably bring up 5 or 10 different assembly level commands.
But none of this typing stuff in with a keyboard like we do now. This was all done with cards.
Punch cards.
With punch cards.
A 7-Eleven punch card.
And so you worked for them for 20 years, and you retired from there, from this nonprofit corporation.
Right.
And they do what for the government now? They
systems engineering. When a contract is let by the government, by, say, Electronic Systems Division, at that time, it's now ESC. the government wouldn't have enough engineers to monitor the contractor work closely enough.
Okay.
So they hired Mitre to be the systems engineer. And we would sit in on the different design reviews and question the contractor's work.
Mm-hmm.
And say, yes, that's good, or no, you have to change it here and there because ...
Oversight.
Yep.
Oversight. Now, did you say this was for military purposes, or...
Yep.
So you're still involved with the military. So RCA
yep.
was, and then you are now.
Yep.
Well, when you retired, did you say in 84? When you were 60?
86.
You were 62. We had you had seen a lot of different things because by then we were beginning to have personal computers by 86. Those
that,
you know,
yeah, 10 years of it, right?
Yeah, about 10 years. Are you still active with the computer? Do you have one? Are you online? Are you active with your computer now or not?
Yes, I have four of them.
Have four of them. I'd say you were pretty active, wouldn't you? Yeah, and you understand. I guess you kept up, and so you understand what's going on now. How simple it is with Windows, and how easy it is. Or do you still use DOS commands?
Once in a while, yes, I go to the command line, but I haven't been doing much with the computer for the last year or so. But I pay a lot of attention to helping other people.
Uh-huh. Now, you said a while ago that you're a ham operator. When did that interest start? Was that back in the 40s? Or?
That started in 1952.
So after
I was still at the broom shop.
Yeah.
There are two hams in there, and another guy and I decided we wanted to learn how to be a ham.
Uh-huh.
And so we did get lessons from these guys. Then when I went over to MIT in spring of 53, there was a guy over there who also wanted to learn. So we studied some more. And that spring, early summer, whatever it was,
mm-hmm.
I went down to the Boston Custom House Tower and got on that fatal, really fatal elevator
uh-huh.
to go up to the 15th or 16th floor. And the higher you go in the elevator, the less your memory is working.
Now
so
what?
When you get up there, you can't remember a damn thing of what you studied.
They say that the higher you go in the elevator, the less your memory works.
Yes.
I hope not.
So I took the novice test
yeah.
and the technician test right after it. So I had two calls when I walked out.
So you took them both in one night?
One day.
Took the novice test.
During the day.
Took the novice test and then the technician test, which is like an advanced class would be now,
yes,
right?
Yes.
I took them both in one day. So you had two calls when you left. Now, were you a code man, CW man?
I was for a while, but I didn't use it much.
Yeah.
And I haven't used it much lately.
And boy, that's a use it or lose it skill, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
If you don't keep up.
Well, I do know some guys who were in World War II who used code a lot and could go anywhere from 35 to 45 words a minute. And they can still do code today.
Yeah.
So when you say use it or lose it, that's only for the beginners. The fellas like me.
The guy that folks that really, of course, now everything is done. You just type now, and it sends. You don't really have to know Morse code anymore, do you?
True.
You just my father. There was a bug sitting on his desk in his shop from the time I can, as long as I can remember. He had an old, and he was a good CW man. Had a, what they call a man. He had a good fist.
Yep.
That's the way they call him.
Characteristic, yep.
Yeah, he had a good fist. He was able to, he was quite fat. My old man preferred CWA. So, you know, if I'm talking on a microphone, I could talk to your mother. So he preferred sending goat.
Yeah.
Well, sir, what goes on in your life now? What do you do now? Do you have any hobbies, any interests,
well,
anything?
I do help a lot of people with their computers. I am on their mornings for an hour and a quarter, talking to three or four other blind hams on the radio. And
yeah.
I listen to a lot of talking books.
Yeah, listen to a lot of talking books. Right? That's one thing the government did right is the talking book program.
Wow, wonderful.
I wish they'd get us to digital, but
that's on the way next year and the year after.
Well, I'd like to live to see it. I wish they'd hurry up. Anyway. So you get on the radio an hour or so each morning, and you read read a lot and help people with their computers, and it doesn't seem to me that your mind has deteriorated any. I would hope at 84 I'm as sharp as you are, sir.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Bob Gilday, sir, and I want to thank you, and I'll be back in touch and let you know when we run this, all right?
I appreciate it.
Thank you. Welcome to Blind Like Me. I'm Phil Parr. You probably know that. Our guest is David Lingebach from where, sir? Where are you? Where do you live?
I'm actually live in Front Royal, Virginia.
Virginia? What's the name of the town again?
Front Royal.
Really?
Uh-huh.
That's a small town? That's a medium-sized city or what?
It's a small town. It's near Winchester, Virginia. It's about an hour outside of Washington, D.C.
Okay, an hour south of Washington.
Actually west of Washington.
Okay. All right, but you don't have any political people don't live there. You aren't influenced by politics there, I suppose.
Surprise, how many people out here commute to D.C.?
That'd be a long commute, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah. they're ready to call Winchester a suburb of D.C.
Really?
That's pretty sad.
It is. It's very sad. What I'm trying to get back to is, I think you told me yesterday that your blindness began at age 30. Is that right?
Well, probably began earlier. I didn't know it until I was like 35. Sometimes count to...
You didn't know that you were going to lose your eyesight?
No. And I didn't
really?
Know I had lost it. When I was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, my peripheral vision was already down to like 12 degrees.
Really?
Yeah.
But you were probably still driving the car.
I was.
that's amazing. And you didn't realize that it was gradually going away?
I knew something was wrong because at the time I owned a retail flower shop.
Uh-huh.
And so I was designing flowers and arrangements. And the key was that I would work with a knife all the time.
Uh-huh.
And when you work with it, you cut your flower and then you throw the knife on the table and then you put the flowers in and then you pick up the knife and cut some more, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I'm always throwing the knife on the table, but I was starting to notice that I couldn't find it.
You couldn't find the knife after you threw it.
I couldn't see the knife.
That's amazing.
I would look all around and I couldn't see the knife, even though it was right smack in front of me. Because
yeah.
I had this tunnel vision.
So obviously you thought something was wrong because you went to an eye doctor and had someone look at you.
Well, the key was renewing my driver's license.
Okay.
And I faked, believe it or not, I faked my way through it 4 years prior to that point. Because I knew something was wrong, but, you know, yeah. I wasn't ready to deal.
But you had no idea as a teenager, as a young man,
no idea.
And
interestingly, because I did, you know, talk about the fact that I couldn't see well at night. which is the common symptom of RP.
Yeah.
And mentioned it to my eye doctor, and he just sort of blew it off. Well, years later, after I've been diagnosed with RP, I ran into the same ophthalmologist and said, "Did you know?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "You did not say anything." And he said, "No, I did not." He said, "First of all," he said, "there was nothing that could be done about it." And there's no prediction as to when it was going to start showing up or how severe it was going to be. And so he did not see the necessity of telling me. And you know what? I'm glad he didn't.
Well, there was no point in scaring you if it was going to happen anyway and nothing could be done about it. What's the difference, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I really actually appreciate the fact that he didn't tell me, because if I had had that in the back of my mind growing up, I may have taken a totally different course, and I would say not a more cautious course.
Yeah.
And so I just lived the first 35 years of my life, you know, like anybody else.
Well, they say ignorance is bliss.
Well,
I suppose,
it was. And of course, I think I mentioned to you yesterday, I also have a hearing loss. And that's an interesting story, because I grew up believing that I had a 30% hearing loss. And when I was, probably like 25, I was teaching in a public school, and the nurse there said, "You know, I'd love to do an audiogram on you." And I hadn't had one done in years. And she did it, and to my amazement, I had a 60% hearing loss, not a 30% hearing loss.
Now, you had a 50% hearing loss.
60%. In other words,
60. Bye.
And it wasn't that my hearing had gotten worse. It's just that I grew up thinking my hearing loss was a lot less severe than it actually was. And again, I didn't wear hearing aids when I was a kid. I didn't wear hearing aids until my vision got so bad I couldn't lip read anymore.
From the way you talk, you're wearing hearing aids now.
I do, yes, because I can't lip read.
You can't see well enough to lip read,
that's
so you
correct.
Have to wear a hearing aid. Now, you said you were teaching at a public school, so you went to college and got a degree.
I have 3 degrees now. I got a bachelor's in music education, and then I have a master's of science in education, and then after I was diagnosed with RP, I went back to school and got a second bachelor's degree in computer science.
Okay, after you were diagnosed with RP.
Yeah.
Well, what were you doing in a flower shop then, if you have all these degrees? You just like flowers?
Entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah.
You know, a friend of mine had the business, and it's just a long story, but I had nothing better going on in my life at the time.
So why not? Yeah, I know the feeling.
Hey, I had it for 7 years.
What vision do you have now? Where are we today as far as vision? Is it all gone?
No, it's not all gone. I keep debating, do I call myself blind or low vision? Because...
Yeah.
Essentially, I have light perception. However, I can still, you know, read the computer and use a CCTV, so I can still read some. But as far as being outdoors and looking at three signs, I can't read that stuff
anymore. No. Well, I think both would apply, low vision both.
Well, and you know, in my business, I use the term visually challenged.
That's one.
I figure it covers the whole gamut.
Yeah, it does. I don't know. Blind is such a broad thing. I'm blind. I really can't see, but I don't consider myself blind. I know a few things. I mean, I'm not blind to society or blind to learning. But anyway, they're all semantics. That's splitting hairs, I suppose. You mentioned what you do now. Now you you have a tell me about your nonprofit foundation.
Well, like I said, I got my computer science degree, and then I worked for 10 years at a university here in D.C. as a computer specialist, and then my vision would just deteriorating more and more, and I was starting to make errors due to my vision, and it was not a environment where people were willing to be accommodating. And so anyway, I quit the job because I just couldn't live with that kind level of
stress.
Not stress. Not stress. No, it wasn't the stress. It was just the level of good performance.
Okay.
So anyway, I left that, and I thought, well, now what do I do with my life? Because I was qualified for Social Security disability.
Oh, yeah, like we all are, sure.
And it was interesting, because this was 1997, and when I applied for disability, they said I was eligible since 1992.
Well, yeah, you've been eligible all the time. You're blind.
Yeah, but they didn't give me back pay.
No, they don't. They're a little stingy about that, aren't they?
Anyway, so I ended up starting my own nonprofit organization called the Out of Sight Foundation.
All right.
It's actually an acronym for Opportunities Unlimited Towards Achievement Without Sight.
That's good.
Actually, I came up with the acronym and then came up with words to fit it.
Yeah, I think that's what most people do.
I have a reputation of being more out of mind than out of sight.
Well, what does the Out of Sight Foundation do?
I have to be honest with you. It's sort of been a exploratory adventure. I started it in 1999. The mission statement is to develop and implement programs that will have a massive impact on the world of those who are visually challenged. Now, why did I start this foundation? Because I have been through various agencies for the blind. I have been through the real-world experience as a blind person. I have been a sighted person for a good portion of my life, so I have a perspective of how society views people who are visually challenged, and being visually challenged myself, I've been on the other side of the coin, and my assessment is that the current system doesn't really work, and so I am setting out to find ways to change the status quo. Now, a lot of things are happening on its own, but I think that there can be even more massive changes. My theory is that it's not just the people who are visually challenged that need education, it's the sighted community that needs education.
Yeah.
As a sighted person, I looked at someone who was blind and said, oh, those poor people, what can they possibly do? And you know what? When I became diagnosed with RP and saw what my future could conceivably be, I looked at myself and said, oh, poor me, what can I possibly do?
Mm-hmm.
And so this is sort of, where I'm coming from.
Now, I got
where
you.
Am I going? Well, I have developed seminars. I have one that I developed called Working with Low Vision Seniors. It's for professionals who interact with senior citizens, either in nursing homes, assisted living facilities, senior daycare facilities. And basically, it's teaching them, it's a full-day seminar, teaching these professionals how to more effectively interact with those who are visually challenged.
All right.
The big key is you treat someone who's visually challenged just like you would treat anybody else. Don't give them exceptions. Don't, patronize them. Don't assume they can't do anything. Don't, what I'm saying?
Yes, sir, I do, but lots of sighted people don't.
I know.
That's what you're saying.
I'm working on that. But then I'm also working on with people who are visually challenged because they need to set their bar higher than I think a lot of them do. I think that a lot of people who are visually challenged feel like their life is limited because of their vision. Well, it's not. It's as limited as you choose to make it.
You want to give us some contact information if somebody could get in touch with you, if they either wanted you to speak to them or they wanted more information about your organization.
Well, that's terrific. There are actually two ways of doing it. Number one would be to go to my website. It's www.outasight.org. That's outasight.org. Or I have an 800 number, which is 1-800-499-6882. It's also 499-OUTA. However, I don't expect many people to remember that. Anyway,
yeah.
Again, it's 800-499-6882.
All right, David, give us your website one more time, and we'll let you go. David Lingelbach is our guest. And what are is the Out of Sight Foundation, the Out of Sight?
The Out of Sight Foundation, and the website is www.outasight.org. That's OUTASIGHT, all one word.
Uh-huh.
And my 800 number is 800-499-6882.
All right, David, thank you, and I'll let you know when we are going to run this on ACB Radio.
That'll be terrific.
All right.
I'm looking forward to it, and thank you very much for calling, and I certainly have enjoyed it.
David Lingelbach and the Out of Sight Foundation. He also, let me mention, offers a newsletter each month. If you'd care to go to the Out of Sight Foundation and sign up, I think there's a little registration form that is just so that he'll know who people are and what sorts of services he needs to provide. Newsletter once a month, the Out of Sight Foundation, David Lingelbach. All right, that's Senator Blind Like Me. If you would like to be a guest, or you know somebody, excuse me, who would make a good guest, do you think, would give me a call, 936-634-9500, or email me. That's Phil at philparr.net. Thank y'all. We appreciate it very much. Try to listen every week, and go back and listen to the old shows if you haven't. Thanks again, Phil Parr, Phil at philparr.net, 936-634-9500. I'm going to go eat lunch. We'll see you later. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.